Those are Spielek, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Eagle II Corporation. The second matter is Genevieve Williamson against Williamson. Our counsel here on that case as well.
Yes, sir.
We have read the briefs. We are familiar with the facts as set forth in those briefs. And also, one of us has, at least one of us has been in the record. So if that helps you in presenting your argument, we hope that that does. And streamlining it, the yellow light will come on when there's 5 minutes left for purposes of the appellant taking time in rebuttal if the appellant wishes to do that. I would ask that anyone with a pager or a cell phone, please turn that off at this time so that we're not disturbed during counsel's argument. And with that request, Mr. McReynolds?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. Glad to be here again. It's been a while. And just because you're at the Court of Appeals as a lawyer, as an appellant, you have to tell yourself, well, you really didn't do anything wrong to get here. It's just a legal issue, after all. So, glad to be here with you. This is an interesting case, I think, because it involves sort of a novel issue, at least fairly novel. I think that the real issue here is how does a trial court sort out who is the proper defendant or employer in a Title VII case? Since that's what our trial judge was faced with, and it's sort of a conundrum. So that's, I think, what we need to look at. What does the trial judge do in this situation? Because here we have a young lady, Ms. Spielek, who goes to work at a Dairy Queen and is hired by someone who apparently is the manager. And over the course of time, ends up working at three different Dairy Queens. And the issue never comes up that she worked for one Dairy Queen or the other or any of that, because she shifts around among the various Dairy Queens and she turns in her timesheets and payroll and such to an office. So that makes sense. Well, then she gets in a situation where she believes that she has been terminated by this same manager.
Is that before or after she receives paychecks?
Before, well, she gets these paychecks, and she gets them from, as you know in the record, from three different companies. But the paychecks all come from the same office, and all the paychecks are signed by the lady at that office. That office is the Eagle II office. Now, the curious thing about...
But the checks are not Eagle II checks.
None of the checks are Eagle II checks. The in the trial court, I think when the issue came up, took the view that it appeared that this Eagle II company was basically like a payroll service, or was providing the accounting services for the company. And obviously, I think we'd all agree that that would not be enough. We're clear on that. And the real question is, when you have these types of situations where in employment cases, this comes up all the time, where you're trying to sort out who's the proper party. You'd think that that would be an easy thing for a person to know or for to be sorted out. But in today's world, corporations are such curious creatures that sometimes it's difficult to sort out. That's why the court has already established in Title VII cases in the federal circuits this idea of the integrated enterprise, or sort of a joint employer theory, and why for forever, we've had these court rules like Rule 19 and Rule 21 about joinder, so the courts can sort out who's the right person that should be in the case. Now,
well, you know, how can a court sort out who the proper defendant is without facts?
Exactly. It's a fact issue. It's a fact issue, and it's not always easy. In this case, it was particularly curious and needed a fact determination. The facts about these interrelated three companies that each own the Dairy Queen, they're all owned by the same two gentlemen, and the fact and the relationship between those and between Eagle 2, which I guess you would call the management company, didn't come out until discovery when the deposition of the district manager was taken. At that point, all the facts were laid out, and of course, then defendant Eagle 2 is challenging this, saying, hey, we're not the right folks. You sued the wrong people. We didn't employ her. We didn't write her any checks. She wasn't on our payroll, so we should be out of the case. If the court then is faced with a fact determination, and if a summary judgment issue is presented where there are questions of fact, it's going to end up in front of a jury to decide who's the employer, who's the proper, is this the right way to go here under this theory? So
I'd like to ask you a question about the application of this integrated enterprise doctrine. And this appears to be an issue of first impression in the Colorado state courts, but apparently it's applied in the lower federal courts.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Now, ordinarily, this court is not under any sort of obligation to give credit to the opinions of a lower federal circuit court. Because the Title VII federal law is closely tied into the state court claim, is there any argument that could be made that that should be a greater rule to look at the federal lower circuit court cases in a case of this nature?
Well, Your Honor, here's how I would look at it. The doctrine of integrated enterprise itself was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, and then eight of the federal circuits have adopted that rule, including the Tenth Circuit. This is the state court, so we don't care about that. We get to interpret Title VII under our own rules. The trial court is faced with that situation of, wait a minute, this integrated enterprise rule, where is this coming from? There's no Colorado cases on this. In fact, I stumbled across a case for the first time last night in Colorado that actually talks about integrated enterprise under a different name. They call it joint employer. And I apologize for not being a better legal scholar, but there was a case some time ago, and I can give you the site if you'd like, that where Colorado had a Colorado Court of Appeals case where the court had to address the same sort of conundrum about the fact issue of who's the employer. Of course, I think that the Tenth Circuit decisions and the federal decisions on this provide some guidance to you as to how other courts have wrestled with this issue. But basically, it's a matter, I think, of logic and common sense to say, all right, in this complicated world that we have, it's perfectly legal for someone to go out and get a Dairy Queen franchise, or two or three, and to set up a separate entity for each one. No problem at all with that. Perfectly legal. Perfectly legal for them to go set up another company to handle the payroll and the accounting services and that sort of thing. If that's all we were looking at, then obviously that Eagle 2 management company shouldn't be here. But the situation is, when you're talking about employer liability and who is the employer, what you really have to look at then is, okay, who's making the decisions about the employees and what's happening with the employees?
But the affidavit that is filed here,
yes,
dispels any kind of factual application of the integrated doctrine that it makes, on its face, it makes the four-way test a loss for you.
Well, here's how I would approach that fact issue, because I think there are some facts that mean it's a fact issue, which is what I think we're faced with. First of all, when Ms. Spielek was hired, she is hired by the district manager of Eagle 2, Ms. Felton. That's an employee decision. When she is fired, she is let go by a manager of Plaza, one of the Dairy Queens, after consultation and basically the approval of that district, same district manager, and the owner, one of the owners of all the companies. Second employment decision. Third issue here that creates a fact issue is if these folks had all had separate entities with separate employees, that's fine. But if you're going to share employees back and forth among all these companies, and if any given day you can be sent to any Dairy Queen, then you have, for purposes of employment decisions, you have this one company, Eagle 2, the district manager, telling people which company to work for that day, all the same rules, all the same rates of pay. That interrelationship, the hiring and firing decision, the shared employees, those things are the things that make Eagle 2 different than just a payroll service or accounting service. Those create issues of fact. The court really didn't address those fact issues and instead looked at issues about the accounting and payroll. But when you have a situation where those employment decisions, which is the key to the whole integrated enterprise doctrine for Title VII, where there's some evidence that those are being made by that management company, which is what it was, then what you have to say is, all right, companies like this, if you want to set up and have separate corporations and a separate management company, payroll service, that's fine. We have no problem with that. But, and you can get the benefit of that. You can have your separate entities for liability or accounting or whatever you want. But if you want to have your cake and eat it too, if you want to set up separate entities for your corporation, but at the same time, you want to function as one company with one centralized management, all owned by the same folks, and you want to share employees among your businesses, okay, then you got to take responsibility then that you probably then are no longer separate. You are in the position where you can fairly be considered interrelated enough that that management company can be considered the employer.
I don't want to use up all your time, but could you address the timing of the motion for joinder of additional defendants?
The motion was made, and shortly before the trial. The reason it couldn't have been made sooner was because of the course of the discovery and the nature of the progress in the case. The court had a chance to review that possible joining of those parties and decided that I was too close to trial. I can understand that because I think a trial court has to struggle with preventing delay and making sure that the trial dockets are effective. But I think the overriding thing is you have to get it right. You have to have the right parties joined, and the court has the power to do that at any point in the proceedings to make sure that you have the right parties. If the court felt that those parties could be joined, is really very little, if any, additional discovery or work. It would simply be like more like an amending the caption than anything else, because the facts and the discovery are basically the same because of the interrelated nature of the parties. I'd like to reserve a little time for rebuttal if I could at this point.
Okay, you have about a minute and 45 seconds, Mr. McReynolds.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is George Castillo, and I represent Eagle II Corporation. I would, at the outset, point out to the court that there's at least one error in my opening brief. On page 24, on the first line, there is a reference to paragraph 19. That reference should be to paragraph 13. We think that it is very clear from the record that Eagle II Corporation presented a series of facts, beginning with the affidavit of Mr. Wingert, who said, we did not hire Ms. Spilek, we didn't employ her, we didn't pay her, we didn't fire her. Then there was an affidavit by Mr. Denhoff, to which we attached the paychecks. And the paychecks clearly show that prior to June of 2006, she received some checks from two entities, and thereafter from Plaza Stores, which was the company that employed her at the time that she was terminated. In fact, the termination check was issued by Plaza Stores. It is also clear from the record that all the W-2s that she received for the year 2006 came from entities other than Eagle II Corporation. Now, our facts were not controverted in any way. There were no affidavits submitted by the claimant, and their only response to our motion for summary judgment was that the integrated enterprise doctrine saved the day for them. Now, counsel made the statement today that Ms. Feldman was Eagle II's district manager. There is absolutely no evidence in the record that supports that. And if one reads the deposition of Ms. Feldman, which is part of the record, one will see that she worked for a number of entities, but not for Eagle II, and that she did not, contrary to what counsel says, hire Ms. Spilek for Eagle II or as a representative of Eagle II. There are a series of statements that have been made on behalf of Ms. Spilek as though there are facts, but are only facts in the imagination of counsel. For instance, there is the idea that Eagle II Corporation was the manager, but there's no evidence of that. The manager of what? What evidence is there that shows that Eagle II Corporation did anything at all concerned with Ms. Spilek as a manager of a business? The determination of the termination of Ms. Spilek was made, as shown by the affidavits, without the participation of Eagle II. In fact, the record, for all the record shows, Eagle II Corporation knew nothing about it. Now, it is true that there are no decisions of any of the Colorado State appellate courts concerning the integrated enterprise doctrine. That doctrine arose in a case that is cited in the briefs, the radio and television case against the NLRB. That's a case that talks about it. It talks about it in the context of, did the NLRB have jurisdiction over the claim that was involved there? Because in that case, a suit was filed in the Alabama State Court. And the Alabama State Court issued orders. The suit was based upon the National Labor Relations Act. The question was, when the case got to the Supreme Court, did the Alabama Supreme Court have jurisdiction over the case? And the answer to that question depended upon whether the NLRB had refused to take jurisdiction or would refuse to take jurisdiction over the case. And the Supreme Court said that the practice of the National Labor Relations Board was to take that kind of case because the jurisdictional amount was present and because, pursuant to its practice, the NLRB would take the case. Therefore, if that was the conclusion, then the State Court of Alabama had no jurisdiction. It's one of those cases where it's dual jurisdiction if the federal agency decides to not take the case. And the conclusion was that based upon the previous administrative cases of the NLRB, it would have taken jurisdiction over the case. And therefore, the Alabama court did not have jurisdiction over that. Now, that principle has, over time, been used by some of the federal courts in analyzing instances, for instance, of a franchisor that has franchises and sets out certain things that the franchisee has to follow. And the cases that are cited in the briefs analyze that situation thoroughly. Now, counsel said today that the mere fact that Eagle II Corporation, for a fee, furnished accounting services would not be sufficient to make it liable in this case. And what else is there? What else is there in the record? It's clear that Eagle II Corporation had no participation at all in the termination of Ms. Feilich as an employee of a store. There were no facts presented to the trial court that in any way involved Eagle II Corporation in the management of the business of Plaza Stores. We still don't know why Eagle II Corporation was sued in the first place. There's nothing in the record that says Ms. Feilich somehow believed that she worked for Eagle II Corporation. There's nothing that Eagle II Corporation said or did that would induce anybody to think that Ms. Feilich worked for Eagle II Corporation. Nothing was presented to the trial court other than the statements of counsel. In one of the, I think is the response to the motion for summary judgment, there's a statement of counsel that says that Ms. Feilich had a reasonable belief that she worked for Eagle II Corporation. Based on what? There's nothing at all in the record that shows that, that shows any reason to believe that. So We filed a motion for summary judgment stating sufficient facts to show that Eagle II Corporation was not the employer of Ms. Spilak. It was then incumbent upon the claimant to come forth and give us some facts, something that said, true, I didn't get paychecks from Plaza Storms, but because of these facts, Eagle II Corporation should be liable to me. That's not in the record. Nothing in the record.
Mr. Castillo, would it have been enough if Ms. Spilak had said in an affidavit, look, I got hired by Joe, and Joe doesn't work at any of the Dairy Queen stores where I worked, but Joe works for Eagle II. I received pay increases, assuming that that was the case, from Joe. When I, even though I didn't get my paychecks from Eagle II, they were signed by Joe. And in the end, when I was fired, Joe fired me. Would that be enough to set forth a question of fact, notwithstanding the affidavits that were filed by Eagle II?
I don't know. It might, except for one thing. Joe, in this case, clearly, her deposition is in the record, did not work for Eagle II. And she participated in the firing decision, but she did not work for Eagle II. That's the problem. I think this is really an afterthought, this business about the integrated enterprise. One would think that if that had been a serious claim, it would have been made in the complaint. There would have been an account that said, Plaza Stores fired me. Another account that says, Eagle II is also responsible because it controls Plaza Stores.
Mr. Castillo, I understand your position that Ms. Felix should have been aware who her employers were from the paycheck stubs and other documentation.
Yes.
But what I'd like to ask is, when was the first legal pleading in which Eagle II claimed not to qualify as an employer?
The answer? In the answer, we admitted certain factual allegations of the complaint. And then we said, if we did not expressly admit it, we are denying it. And one of those is the allegation that says that the store that employed her belonged to Eagle II Corporation. As the trial court found, that was in the case from the beginning.
Okay, so other than a general denial, though, when was the first point that they specifically pled that they were not the employer?
In the motion for summary judgment.
And how close was that to when the case was set for trial?
I can tell you the motion for summary judgment was filed on November, let's see. Maybe it was in December. December 16th. Is that it? Yeah. Okay.
Okay, and then my next question, I guess, is how quickly after that did Ms. Felix move to join additional defendants?
Around the, let's see. December 16th is the date when the complaint, the response was filed. Part of the response was a motion to add parties. And actually, a motion for summary judgment was filed on November the 16th. The answer to that was filed on December the 16th.
What discovery was undertaken prior to the motion for summary judgment?
We took the plaintiff's deposition, and she took the deposition of Ms. Feldman, which is part of the record, and the deposition of the manager of the store where she was employed when she was fired. I'm about to run out of time, so I will sit down. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Castillo. Mr. McReynolds, you have a minute and 42 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. McReynolds, were Rule 26 disclosures filed in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And when were those filed?
Prior to the depositions being taken. I can't give you the exact date. I can tell you that.
Did Eagle II's Rule 26 disclosures identify who the various companies were in connection with the operation of the Dairy Queens?
No. In fact, that was part of the problem, that they produced, Eagle II produced, when asked for an employment manual for employees, produced a manual that later in discovery was attributed to Plaza. The difficulty here was that from the time the EEOC charge was filed up until the summary judgment motion, Eagle II never raised the issue in any meaningful way that it was not the employer. It went along with the EEOC investigation. It participated in mediation at the EEOC, and it was rather a clever way to sort of hide the ball on the liability question. When it became apparent that Ms. Feldman said, I am the district manager, I hired her, I was consulted about firing her, and the facts came out that there were these entities with completely different names, that's when it became apparent that we have to look in terms of the reality of this thing and talk about, is this enterprise, the way this business is run, interrelated enough that that doctrine applies? Because if you have a situation where that occurs, it can be very important. Now, the case I was referring to earlier under a totally different name is the Bigby case, which is Bigby versus Big Three Supply at 937 P. Second 794, Colorado App, 1996. In that case, that was an ADA claim, and the issue was whether or not two companies were interrelated enough to meet what the court called the single employer theory. And at page 798 of that decision, they cite the exact same criteria for the integrated enterprise theory and apply it. Just use a different name. That's why we couldn't find it.
The red light means that you need to sit down, Mr. McReynolds.
Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. Mr. Castillo, would you like to have an opportunity to respond to this case at 937 Pacific Second, 734?
I would.
You have 5 days to send us a letter, one page in length, providing your take on the case. And if you'd send that letter to each of the three of us, please. And a copy, of course, to Mr. McReynolds. All right. Thank you, Mr. Castillo. Thank you, Mr. McReynolds. This matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.